especially as the factors which have to be taken into account become so numerous that it is impossible to gain a synoptic view of them, that decentralization becomes imperative. But once decentralization is necessary, the problem of coordination arises, a coordination which leaves the separate agencies free to adjust their activities to the facts which only they can know, and yet brings about a mutual adjustment of their respective plans. As decentralization has become necessary because nobody can consciously balance all the considerations bearing on the decisions of so many individuals, the coordination can clearly be effected not by conscious control, but only by arrangements which convey to each agent the information he must possess in order effectively to adjust his decisions to those of others. And because all the details of the changes constantly affecting the conditions of demand and supply of the different commodities can never be fully known, or quickly enough be collected and disseminated by any one center, what is required is some apparatus of registration which automatically records all the relevant effects of individual actions, and whose indications are at the same time the resultant of, and the guide for, all the individual decisions. This is precisely what the price system does under competition, and which no other system even promises to accomplish. It enables entrepreneurs, by watching the movement of comparatively few prices, as an engineer watches the hands of a few dials, to adjust their activities to those of their fellows. The important point here is that the price system will fulfill this function only if competition prevails, that is, if the individual producer has to adapt himself to price changes and cannot control them. The more complicated the whole, the more dependent we become on that division of knowledge between individuals whose separate efforts are coordinated by the impersonal mechanism for transmitting the relevant information known by us as the price system. It is no exaggeration to say that if we had had to rely on conscious central planning for the growth of our industrial system, it would never have reached the degree of differentiation, complexity, and flexibility it has attained. Compared with this method of solving the economic problem by means of decentralization plus automatic coordination, the more obvious method of central direction is incredibly clumsy, primitive, and limited in scope. That the division of labor has reached the extent which makes modern civilization possible, we owe to the fact that it did not have to be consciously created, but that man tumbled on a method by which the division of labor could be extended far beyond the limits within which it could have been planned. Any further growth of its complexity, therefore, far from making central direction more necessary, makes it more important than ever that we should use a technique which does not depend on conscious control. There is yet another theory which connects the growth of monopolies with technological progress, and which uses arguments almost opposite to those we have just considered. Though not often clearly stated, it has also exercised considerable influence. It contends not that modern technique destroys competition, but that, on the contrary, it will be impossible to make use of many of the new technological possibilities unless protection against competition is granted, i.e., a monopoly is conferred. This type of argument is not necessarily fraudulent, as the critical reader will perhaps suspect. The obvious answer, that if a new technique for satisfying our wants is really better, it ought to be able to stand up against all competition, does not dispose of all instances to which this argument refers. No doubt in many cases it is used merely as a form of special pleading by interested parties. Even more often, it is probably based on a confusion between technical excellence from a narrow engineering point of view and desirability from the point of view of society as a whole. There remains, however, a group of instances where the argument has some force. It is, for example, at least conceivable that the British automobile industry might be able to supply a car cheaper and better than cars used to be in the United States if everyone in England were made to use the same kind of car, or that the use of electricity, for all purposes, could be made cheaper than coal or gas, if everybody could be made to use only electricity. In instances like these, it is at least possible that we might all be better off and should prefer the new situation if we had the choice, but that no individual ever gets the choice, because the alternative is either that we should all use the same cheap car, or all should use only electricity, or that we should have the choice between these things with each of them at a much higher price. I do not know whether this is true in either of the instances given, but it must be admitted that it is possible that by compulsory standardization or the prohibition of variety beyond a certain degree, abundance might be increased in some fields more than sufficiently to compensate for the restriction of the choice of the consumer. It is even conceivable that a new invention may be made someday whose adoption would seem unquestionably beneficial, but which could be used only if many or all people were made to avail themselves of it at the same time. Whether such instances are of any great or lasting importance, they are certainly not instances where it could be legitimately claimed that technical progress makes central direction inevitable. They would merely make it necessary to choose between gaining a particular advantage by compulsion and not obtaining it, or, in most instances, obtaining it a little later, when further technical advance has overcome the particular difficulties. It is true that in such situations we may have to sacrifice a possible immediate gain as the price of our freedom, but we avoid, on the other hand, the necessity of making future developments dependent upon the knowledge which particular people now possess. By sacrificing such possible present advantages, we preserve an important stimulus to further progress. Though in the short run, the price we have to pay for variety and freedom of choice may sometimes be high, in the long run, even material progress will depend on this very variety, because we can never predict from which of the many forms in which a good or service can be provided, something better may develop. It cannot, of course, be asserted that the preservation of freedom at the expense of some addition to our present material comfort will be thus rewarded in all instances. But the argument for freedom is precisely that we ought to leave room for the unforeseeable free growth. It applies, therefore, no less when, on the basis of our present knowledge, compulsion would seem to bring only advantages, and although in a particular instance it may actually do no harm. In much of the current discussion on the effects of technological progress, this progress is presented to us as if it were something outside us, which could compel us to use the new knowledge in a particular way. While it is true, of course, that inventions have given us tremendous power, it is absurd to suggest that we must use this power to destroy our most precious inheritance, liberty. It does mean, however, that if we want to preserve it, we must guard it more jealously than ever, and that we must be prepared to make sacrifices for it. While there is nothing in modern technological developments which forces us toward comprehensive economic planning, there is a great deal in them which makes infinitely more dangerous the power a planning authority would possess. While there can thus be little doubt that the movement toward planning is the result of deliberate action, and that there are no external necessities which force us to it, it is worth inquiring why so large a proportion of the technical experts should be found in the front rank of the planners. The explanation of this phenomenon is closely connected with an important fact which the critics of the planners should always keep in mind, that there is little question that almost every one of the technical ideals of our experts could be realized within a comparatively short time, if to achieve them were made the sole aim of humanity. There is an infinite number of good things, which we all agree are highly desirable as well as possible, but of which we cannot hope to achieve more than a few within our lifetime, or which we can hope to achieve only very imperfectly. It is the frustration of his ambitions in his own field which makes the specialist revolt against the existing order. We all find it difficult to bear to see things left undone which everybody must admit are both desirable and possible, that these things cannot all be done at the same time, that any one of them can be achieved only at the sacrifice of others, can be seen only by taking into account factors which fall outside any specialism, which can be appreciated only by a painful intellectual effort, the more painful as it forces us to see against a wider background the objects to which most of our labors are directed, and to balance them against others which lie outside our immediate interest, and for which, for that reason, we care less. Every one of the many things which, considered in isolation, it would be possible to achieve in a planned society, creates enthusiasts for planning who feel confident that they will be able to instill into the directors of such a society their sense of the value of the particular objective. And the hopes of some of them would undoubtedly be fulfilled, since a planned society would certainly further some objectives more than is the case at present. It would be foolish to deny that the instances of planned or semi-planned societies, which we know do furnish illustrations in point, good things which the people of these countries owe entirely to planning. The magnificent motor roads in Germany and Italy are an instance often quoted, even though they do not represent a kind of planning not equally possible in a liberal society. But it is equally foolish to quote such instances of technical excellence in particular fields as evidence of the general superiority of planning. It would be more correct to say that such extreme technical excellence out of line with general conditions is evidence of a misdirection of resources. Anyone who has driven along the famous German motor roads and found the amount of traffic on them less than on many a secondary road in England can have little doubt that, so far as peace purposes are concerned, there was little justification for them. Whether it was not a case where the planners decided in favor of guns instead of butter is another matter. But, as I am correcting this, the news comes that maintenance work on the German motor roads has been suspended. But by our standards, there is little ground for enthusiasm. The illusion of the specialist that in a planned society he would secure more attention to the objectives for which he cares most is a more general phenomenon than the term specialist at first suggests. In our predilections and interests, we are all in some measure specialists, and we all think that our personal order of values is not merely personal, but that in a free discussion among rational people, we would convince the others that ours is the right one. The lover of the countryside, who wants, above all, that its traditional appearance should be preserved, and that the blots already made by industry on its fair face should be removed, no less than the health enthusiast, who wants all the picturesque but insanitary old cottages cleared away, or the motorist, who wishes the country cut up by big motor roads, the efficiency fanatic, who desires the maximum of specialization and mechanization, no less than the idealist, who, for the development of personality, wants to preserve as many independent craftsmen as possible. All know that their aim can be fully achieved only by planning, and they all want planning for that reason. But, of course, the adoption of the social planning for which they clamor can only bring out the concealed conflict between their aims. The movement for planning owes its present strength largely to the fact that, while planning is in the main still an ambition, it unites almost all the single-minded idealists, all the men and women who have devoted their lives to a single task. The hopes they place in planning, however, are the result not of a comprehensive view of society, but rather of a very limited view, and often the result of a great exaggeration of the importance of the ends they place foremost. This is not to underrate the great pragmatic value of this type of men in a free society like ours, which makes them the subject of just admiration. But it would make the very men who are most anxious to plan society the most dangerous, if they were allowed to do so, and the most intolerant of the planning of others. From the saintly and single-minded idealist to the fanatic is often but a step. Though it is the resentment of the frustrated specialist which gives the demand for planning its strongest impetus, there could hardly be a more unbearable and more irrational world than one in which the most eminent specialists in each field were allowed to proceed unchecked with the realization of their ideals. Nor can coordination, as some planners seem to imagine, become a new specialism. The economist is the last to claim that he has the knowledge which the coordinator would need. His plea is for a method which effects such coordination without the need for an omniscient dictator. But that means precisely the retention of some such impersonal and often unintelligible checks on individual efforts, as those against which all specialists chafe. Chapter 5. Planning and Democracy. The statesman who should attempt to direct private people in what manner they ought to employ their capitals would not only load himself with the most unnecessary attention, but assume an authority which could safely be trusted to no council and senate whatever, and which would nowhere be so dangerous as in the hands of a man who had folly and presumption enough to fancy himself fit to exercise it. Adam Smith. The common features of all collectivist systems may be described, in a phrase ever dear to socialists of all schools, as the deliberate organization of the labors of society for a definite social goal. That our present society lacks such conscious direction toward a single aim, that its activities are guided by the whims and fancies of irresponsible individuals, has always been one of the main complaints of its socialist critics. In many ways, this puts the basic issue very clearly, and it directs us at once to the point where the conflict arises between individual freedom and collectivism. The various kinds of collectivism, communism, fascism, etc., differ among themselves in the nature of the goal toward which they want to direct the efforts of society. But they all differ from liberalism and individualism in wanting to organize the whole of society and all its resources for this unitary end, and in refusing to recognize autonomous spheres in which the ends of the individuals are supreme. In short, they are totalitarian in the true sense of this new word, which we have adopted to describe the unexpected, but nevertheless inseparable manifestations of what in theory we call collectivism. The social goal or common purpose for which society is to be organized is usually vaguely described as the common good, the general welfare, or the general interest. It does not need much reflection to see that these terms have no sufficiently definite meaning to determine a particular course of action. The welfare and the happiness of millions cannot be measured on a single scale of less and more. The welfare of a people, like the happiness of a man, depends on a great many things that can be provided in an infinite variety of combinations. It cannot be adequately expressed as a single end, but only as a hierarchy of ends, a comprehensive scale of values in which every need of every person is given its place. To direct all our activities according to a single plan presupposes that every one of our needs is given its rank in an order of values which must be complete enough to make it possible to decide among all the different courses which the planner has to choose. It presupposes, in short, the existence of a complete ethical code, in which all the different human values are allotted their due place. The conception of a complete ethical code is unfamiliar, and it requires some effort of imagination to see what it involves. We are not in the habit of thinking of moral codes as more or less complete. The fact that we are constantly choosing between different values without a social code prescribing how we ought to choose does not surprise us, and does not suggest to us that our moral code is incomplete. In our society, there is neither occasion nor reason why people should develop common views about what should be done in such situations. But where all the means to be used are the property of society, and are to be used in the name of society according to a unitary plan, a social view about what ought to be done must guide all decisions. In such a world, we should soon find that our moral code is full of gaps. We are not concerned here with the question whether it would be desirable to have such a complete ethical code. It may merely be pointed out that, up to the present, the growth of civilization has been accompanied by a steady diminution of the sphere in which individual actions are bound by fixed rules. The rules of which our common moral code consists have progressively become fewer and more general in character. From the primitive man, who was bound by an elaborate ritual in almost every one of his daily activities, who was limited by innumerable taboos, and who could scarcely conceive of doing things in a way different from his fellows, morals have more and more tended to become merely limits circumscribing the sphere within which the individual could behave as he liked. The adoption of a common ethical code, comprehensive enough to determine a unitary economic plan, would mean a complete reversal of this tendency. The essential point for us is that no such complete ethical code exists. The attempt to direct all economic activity according to a single plan would raise innumerable questions to which the answer could be provided only by a moral rule, but to which existing morals have no answer, and where there exists no agreed view on what ought to be done. People will have either no definite views or conflicting views on such questions, because in the free society in which we have lived, there has been no occasion to think about them, and still less to form common opinions about them. Not only do we not possess such an all-inclusive scale of values, it would be impossible for any mind to comprehend the infinite variety of different needs of different people which compete for the available resources, and to attach a definite weight to each. For our problem, it is of minor importance whether the ends for which any person cares comprehend only his own individual needs, or whether they include the needs of his closer or even those of his more distant fellows, that is, whether he is egoistic or altruistic, in the ordinary senses of these words. The point which is so important is the basic fact that it is impossible for any man to survey more than a limited field, to be aware of the urgency of more than a limited number of needs. Whether his interests center round his own physical needs, or whether he takes a warm interest in the welfare of every human being he knows, the ends about which he can be concerned will always be only an infinitesimal fraction of the needs of all men. This is the fundamental fact on which the whole philosophy of individualism is based. It does not assume, as is often asserted, that man is egoistic or selfish or ought to be. It merely starts from the indisputable fact that the limits of our powers of imagination make it impossible to include in our scale of values more than a sector of the needs of the whole society, and that, since, strictly speaking, scales of value can exist only in individual minds, nothing but partial scales of values exist, scales which are inevitably different and often inconsistent with each other. From this, the individualist concludes that the individuals should be allowed, within defined limits, to follow their own values and preferences rather than somebody else's, that within these spheres the individual's system of ends should be supreme and not subject to any dictation by others. It is this recognition of the individual as the ultimate judge of his ends, the belief that, as far as possible, his own views ought to govern his actions, that forms the essence of the individualist position. This view does not, of course, exclude the recognition of social ends, or rather of a coincidence of individual ends which makes it advisable for men to combine for their pursuit. But it limits such common action to the instances where individual views coincide. What are called social ends are for it merely identical ends of many individuals, or ends to the achievement of which individuals are willing to contribute in return for the assistance they receive in the satisfaction of their own desires. Common action is thus limited to the fields where people agree on common ends. Very frequently, these common ends will not be ultimate ends to the individuals, but means which different persons can use for different purposes. In fact, people are most likely to agree on common action, where the common end is not an ultimate end to them, but a means capable of serving a great variety of purposes. When individuals combine in a joint effort to realize ends they have in common, the organizations, like the state, that they form for this purpose, are given their own system of ends and their own means. But any organization thus formed remains one person among others. In the case of the state, much more powerful than any of the others, it is true, yet still with its separate and limited sphere, in which alone its ends are supreme. The limits of this sphere are determined by the extent to which the individuals agree on particular ends, and the probability that they will agree on a particular course of action necessarily decreases as the scope of such action extends. There are certain functions of the state on the exercise of which there will be practical unanimity among its citizens. There will be others on which there will be agreement of a substantial majority, and so on, until we come to fields where, although each individual might wish the state to act in some way, there will be almost as many views about what the government should do as there are different people. We can rely on voluntary agreement to guide the action of the state only so long as it is confined to spheres where agreement exists. But not only when the state undertakes direct control in fields where there is no such agreement, is it bound to suppress individual freedom. We can, unfortunately, not indefinitely extend the sphere of common action and still leave the individual free in his own sphere. Once the communal sector, in which the state controls all the means, exceeds a certain proportion of the whole, the effects of its actions dominate the whole system. Although the state controls directly the use of only a large part of the available resources, the effects of its decisions on the remaining part of the economic system become so great that, indirectly, it controls almost everything. Where, as was, for example, true in Germany as early as 1928, the central and local authorities directly control the use of more than half the national income. According to an official German estimate then, 53%, they control indirectly almost the whole economic life of the nation. There is, then, scarcely an individual end which is not dependent for its achievement on the action of the state, and the social scale of values which guides the state's action must embrace practically all individual ends. It is not difficult to see what must be the consequences when democracy embarks upon a course of planning which in its execution requires more agreement than in fact exists. The people may have agreed on adopting a system of directed economy because they have been convinced that it will produce great prosperity. In the discussions leading to the decision, the goal of planning will have been described by some such term as common welfare, which only conceals the absence of real agreement on the ends of planning. Agreement will, in fact, exist only on the mechanism to be used. But it is a mechanism which can be used only for a common end, and the question of the precise goal toward which all activity is to be directed will arise as soon as the executive power has to translate the demand for a single plan into a particular plan. Then it will appear that the agreement on the desirability of planning is not supported by agreement on the ends the plan is to serve. The effect of the people's agreeing that there must be central planning, without agreeing on the ends, will be rather as if a group of people were to commit themselves to take a journey together without agreeing where they want to go, with the result that they may all have to make a journey which most of them do not want at all. That planning creates a situation in which it is necessary for us to agree on a much larger number of topics than we have been used to, and that in a planned system we cannot confine collective action to the tasks on which we can agree, but are forced to produce agreement on everything in order that any action can be taken at all, is one of the features which contributes more than most to determining the character of a planned system. It may be the unanimously expressed will of the people that its parliament should prepare a comprehensive economic plan, yet neither the people nor its representatives need therefore be able to agree on any particular plan. The inability of democratic assemblies to carry out what seems to be a clear mandate of the people will inevitably cause dissatisfaction with democratic institutions. Parliaments come to be regarded as ineffective talking shops, unable or incompetent to carry out the tasks for which they have been chosen. The conviction grows that if efficient planning is to be done, the direction must be taken out of politics and placed in the hands of experts, permanent officials, or independent autonomous bodies. The difficulty is well known to socialists. It will soon be half a century since the Webbs began to complain of the increased incapacity of the House of Commons to cope with its work. Sidney and Beatrice Webb, Industrial Democracy, 1897, page 800, note. More recently, Professor Lasky has elaborated the argument. It is common ground that the present parliamentary machine is quite unsuited to pass rapidly a great body of complicated legislation. The national government, indeed, has, in substance, admitted this by implementing its economy and tariff measures, not by detailed debate in the House of Commons, but by a wholesale system of delegated legislation. A labor government would, I presume, build upon the amplitude of this precedent. It would confine the House of Commons to the two functions it can properly perform, the ventilation of grievances and the discussion of general principles of its measures. Its bills would take the form of general formulae, conferring wide powers on the appropriate government departments, and those powers would be exercised by order in council, which could, if desired, be attacked in the House by means of a vote of no confidence. The necessity and value of delegated legislation has recently been strongly reaffirmed by the Donimore Committee, and its extension is inevitable if the process of socialization is not to be wrecked by the normal methods of obstruction which existing parliamentary procedures sanctions. And to make it quite clear that a socialist government must not allow itself to be too much fettered by democratic procedure, Professor Lasky, at the end of the same article, raised the question whether in a period of transition to socialism, a labor government can risk the overthrow of its measures as a result of the next general election, and left it significantly unanswered. H.J. Lasky, Labor and the Constitution, New Statesman and Nation, Number 81, New Series, September 10, 1932, page 277. In a book, Democracy in Crisis, 1933, particularly page 87, in which Professor Lasky later elaborated these ideas, his determination that parliamentary democracy must not be allowed to form an obstacle to the realization of socialism is even more plainly expressed. Not only would a socialist government take vast powers and legislate under them by ordinance and decree, and suspend the classic formulae of normal opposition, but the continuance of parliamentary government would depend on its, i.e. the labor government's, possession of guarantees from the Conservative Party that its work of transformation would not be disrupted by repeal in the event of its defeat at the polls. As Professor Lasky invokes the authority of the Donimore Committee, it may be worth recalling that Professor Lasky was a member of that committee, and presumably one of the authors of its report. It is important, clearly, to see the causes of this admitted ineffectiveness of parliaments when it comes to a detailed administration of the economic affairs of a nation. The fault is neither with the individual representatives, nor with parliamentary institutions as such, but with the contradictions inherent in the task with which they are charged. They are not asked to act where they can agree, but to produce agreement on everything, the whole direction of the resources of the nation. For such a task, the system of majority decision is, however, not suited. Majorities will be found where it is a choice between limited alternatives, but it is a superstition to believe that there must be a majority view on everything. There is no reason why there should be a majority in favor of any one of the different possible courses of positive action if their number is legion. Every member of the Legislative Assembly might prefer some particular plan for the direction of economic activity to no plan, yet no one plan may appear preferable to a majority to no plan at all. Nor can a coherent plan be achieved by breaking it up into parts and voting on particular issues. A Democratic Assembly voting and amending a comprehensive economic plan clause by clause as it deliberates on an ordinary bill makes nonsense. An economic plan, to deserve the name, must have a unitary conception. Even if a Parliament could, proceeding step by step, agree on some scheme, it would certainly, in the end, satisfy nobody. A complex whole in which all the parts must be most carefully adjusted to each other cannot be achieved through a compromise between conflicting views. To draw up an economic plan in this fashion is even less possible than, for example, successfully to plan a military campaign by democratic procedure. As in strategy, it would become inevitable to delegate the task to the experts. Yet the difference is that, while the general who is put in charge of a campaign is given a single end to which, for the duration of the campaign, all the means under his control have to be exclusively devoted, there can be no such single goal given to the economic planner, and no similar limitation of the means imposed upon him. The general has not got to balance different independent aims against each other. There is, for him, only one supreme goal. But the ends of an economic plan, or of any part of it, cannot be defined apart from the particular plan. It is the essence of the economic problem that the making of an economic plan involves the choice between conflicting or competing ends, different needs of different people. But which ends do so conflict, which will have to be sacrificed if we want to achieve certain others? In short, which are the alternatives between which we must choose can only be known to those who know all the facts, and only they, the experts, are in a position to decide which of the different ends are to be given preference. It is inevitable that they should impose their scale of preferences on the community for which they plan. This is not always clearly recognized, and delegation is usually justified by the technical character of the task. But this does not mean that only the technical detail is delegated, or even that the inability of parliaments to understand the technical detail is the root of the difficulty. It is instructive in this connection briefly to refer to the government document in which, in recent years, these problems have been discussed. As long as 13 years ago, that is, before England finally abandoned economic liberalism, the process of delegating legislative powers had already been carried to a point where it was felt necessary to appoint a committee to investigate what safeguards are desirable or necessary to secure the sovereignty of law. In its report, the Dunamore Committee, Report of the Lord Chancellor's Committee and Minister's Powers, Command 4060, 1932, showed that even at that date, Parliament had resorted to the practice of wholesale and indiscriminate delegation, but regarded this, it was before we had really glanced into the totalitarian abyss, as an inevitably and relatively innocuous development. And it is probably true that delegation as such need not be a danger to freedom. The interesting point is why delegation had become necessary on such a scale. First place among the causes enumerated in the report is given to the fact that Parliament nowadays passes so many laws every year, and that much of the detail is so technical as to be unsuitable for parliamentary discussion. But if this were all, there would be no reason why the details should not be worked out before rather than after Parliament passes a law. What is probably in many cases a much more important reason why, if Parliament were not willing to delegate law-making power, Parliament would be unable to pass the kind and quantity of legislation which public opinion requires, is innocently revealed in the little sentence that many of the laws affect people's lives so closely that elasticity is essential. What does this mean, if not conferment of arbitrary power? Power limited by no fixed principles, and which, in the opinion of Parliament, cannot be limited by definite and unambiguous rules. Alterations in the structure of civil law are no less technical and no more difficult to appreciate in all their implications. Yet, nobody has yet seriously suggested that legislation there should be delegated to a body of experts. The fact is that, in these fields, legislation does not go beyond general rules on which true majority agreement can be achieved, while in the direction of economic activity, the interests to be reconciled are so divergent that no true agreement is likely to be reached in a democratic assembly. It should be recognized, however, that it is not the delegation of lawmaking power as such which is so objectionable. To oppose delegation as such is to oppose a symptom instead of the cause, and, as it may be a necessary result of other causes, to weaken the case. So long as the power that is delegated is merely the power to make general rules, there may be very good reasons why such rules should be laid down by local rather than by the central authority. The objectionable feature is that delegation is so often resorted to because the matter in hand cannot be regulated by general rules, but only by the exercise of discretion in the decision of particular cases. In these instances, delegation means that some authority is given power to make, with the force of law, what to all intents and purposes are arbitrary decisions, usually described as judging the case on its merits. The delegation of particular technical tasks to separate bodies, while a regular feature, is yet only the first step in the process whereby a democracy which embarks on planning progressively relinquishes its powers. The expedient of delegation cannot really remove the causes which make all the advocates of comprehensive planning so impatient with the impotence of democracy. The delegation of particular powers to separate agencies creates a new obstacle to the achievement of a single coordinated plan, even if, by this expedient, a democracy should succeed in planning every sector of economic activity. It would still have to face the problem of integrating these separate plans into a unitary whole. Many separate plans do not make a planned whole. In fact, as the planners ought to be the first to admit, they may be worse than no plan. But the Democratic legislature will long hesitate to relinquish the decisions on really vital issues, and so long as it does so, it makes it impossible for anyone else to provide the comprehensive plan. Yet agreement that planning is necessary, together with the inability of Democratic assemblies to produce a plan, will evoke stronger and stronger demands that the government or some single individual should be given powers to act on their own responsibility. The belief is becoming more and more widespread that, if things are to get done, the responsible authorities must be freed from the fetters of democratic procedure. The cry for an economic dictator is a characteristic stage in the movement toward planning. It is now several years since one of the most acute of foreign students of England, the late Elie Halévy, suggested that if you take a composite photograph of Lord Eustace Percy, Sir Oswald Mosley, and Sir Stafford Cripps, I think you would find this common feature. You would find them all agreeing to say, we are living in economic chaos, and we cannot get out of it except under some kind of dictatorial leadership. Socialism and the Problems of Democratic Parliamentarianism. International Affairs. Volume 13, page 501. The number of influential public men whose inclusion would not materially alter the features of the composite photograph has since grown considerably. In Germany, even before Hitler came into power, the movement had already progressed much further. It is important to remember that, for some time before 1933, Germany had reached a stage in which it had, in effect, had to be governed dictatorially. Nobody could then doubt that, for the time being, democracy had broken down, and that sincere Democrats, like Brennig, were no more able to govern democratically than Schleicher or von Papen. Hitler did not have to destroy democracy. He merely took advantage of the decay of democracy and, at the critical moment, obtained the support of many to whom, though they detested Hitler, he yet seemed the only man strong enough to get things done. The argument by which the planners usually try to reconcile us with this development is that, so long as democracy retains ultimate control, the essentials of democracy are not affected. Thus, Karl Mannheim writes, "The only way in which a planned society differs from that of the 19th century is that more and more spheres of social life, and ultimately each and all of them, are subjected to state control. But if a few controls can be held in check by parliamentary sovereignty, so can many. In a democratic state, sovereignty can be boundlessly strengthened by plenary powers without renouncing democratic control." Man and Society in an Age of Reconstruction, 1940, page 340. This belief overlooks a vital distinction. Parliament can, of course, control the execution of tasks where it can give definite directions, where it has first agreed on the aim and merely delegates the working out of the detail. The situation is entirely different when the reason for the delegation is that there is no real agreement on the ends, when the body charged with the planning has to choose between ends of whose conflict Parliament is not even aware, and when the most that can be done is to present to it a plan which has to be accepted or rejected as a whole. There may and probably will be criticism, but as no majority can agree on an alternative plan, and the parts objected to can almost always be represented as essential parts of the whole, it will remain quite ineffective. Parliamentary discussion may be retained as a useful safety valve, and even more, as a convenient medium through which the official answers to complaints are disseminated. It may even prevent some flagrant abuses and successfully insist on particular shortcomings being remedied. But it cannot direct. It will, at best, be reduced to choosing the persons who are to have practically absolute power. The whole system will tend toward that plebiscitarian dictatorship in which the head of the government is, from time to time, confirmed in his position by popular vote, but where he has all the powers at his command to make certain that the vote will go in the direction he desires. It is the price of democracy that the possibilities of conscious control are restricted to the fields where true agreement exists, and that in some fields things must be left to chance. But in a society which, for its functioning, depends on central planning, this control cannot be made dependent on a majority's being able to agree. It will often be necessary that the will of a small minority be imposed upon the people, because this minority will be the largest group able to agree among themselves on the question at issue. Democratic government has worked successfully where, and so long as, the functions of government were, by a widely accepted creed, restricted to fields where agreement among a majority could be achieved by free discussion. And it is the great merit of the liberal creed that it reduced the range of subjects on which agreement was necessary to one on which it was likely to exist in a society of free men. It is now often said that democracy will not tolerate capitalism. If capitalism means here a competitive system based on free disposal over private property, it is far more important to realize that only within this system is democracy possible. When it becomes dominated by a collectivist creed, democracy will inevitably destroy itself. We have no intention, however, of making a fetish of democracy. It may well be true that our generation talks and thinks too much of democracy and too little of the values which it serves. It cannot be said of democracy, as Lord Acton truly said of liberty, that it is not a means to a higher political end. It is itself the highest political end. It is not for the sake of a good public administration that it is required, but for the security in the pursuit of the highest objects of civil society and of private life. Democracy is essentially a means, a utilitarian device for safeguarding internal peace and individual freedom. As such, it is by no means infallible or certain. Nor must we forget that there has often been much more cultural and spiritual freedom under an autocratic rule than under some democracies. And it is at least conceivable that under the government of a very homogeneous and doctrinaire majority, democratic government might be as oppressive as the worst dictatorship. Our point, however, is not that dictatorship must inevitably extirpate freedom, but rather that planning leads to dictatorship, because dictatorship is the most effective instrument of coercion and the enforcement of ideals, and as such, essential if central planning on a large scale is to be possible. The clash between planning and democracy arises simply from the fact that the latter is an obstacle to the suppression of freedom, which the direction of economic activity requires. But insofar as democracy ceases to be a guarantee of individual freedom, it may well persist in some form under a totalitarian regime. A true dictatorship of the proletariat, even if democratic in form, if it undertook centrally to direct the economic system, would probably destroy personal freedom as completely as any autocracy has ever done. The fashionable concentration on democracy as the main value threatened is not without danger. It is largely responsible for the misleading and unfounded belief that, so long as the ultimate source of power is the will of the majority, the power cannot be arbitrary. The false assurance which many people derive from this belief is an important cause of the general unawareness of the dangers which we face. There is no justification for the belief that, so long as power is conferred by democratic procedure, it cannot be arbitrary. The contrast suggested by this statement is altogether false. It is not the source, but the limitation of power which prevents it from being arbitrary. Democratic control may prevent power from becoming arbitrary, but it does not do so by its mere existence. If democracy resolves on a task which necessarily involves the use of power which cannot be guided by fixed rules, it must become arbitrary power. Chapter 6. Planning and the Rule of Law. Recent studies in the sociology of law once more confirm that the fundamental principle of formal law by which every case must be judged according to general rational precepts, which have as few exceptions as possible and are based on logical subsumptions, obtains only for the liberal competitive phase of capitalism. Karl Mannheim. Nothing distinguishes more clearly conditions in a free country from those in a country under arbitrary government than the observance in the former of the great principles known as the rule of law. Stripped of all technicalities, this means that government in all its actions is bound by rules fixed and announced beforehand, rules which make it possible to foresee with fair certainty how the authority will use its coercive powers in given circumstances, and to plan one's individual affairs on the basis of this knowledge. According to the classical exposition by A.V. Dicey in The Law of Constitution, 8th edition, page 198, the rule of law means in the first place the absolute supremacy or predominance of regular law as opposed to the influence of arbitrary power, and excludes the existence of arbitrariness, of prerogative, or even of wide discretionary authority on the part of government. Largely as a result of Dicey's work, the term has, however, in England, acquired a narrower technical meaning, which does not concern us here. The wider and older meaning of the concept of the rule or reign of law, which in England had become an established tradition which was more taken for granted than discussed, has been most fully elaborated, just because it raised what were new problems there, in the early 19th century discussion in Germany about the nature of the Reichsstadt. Though this ideal can never be perfectly achieved, since legislators as well as those to whom the administration of the law is entrusted are fallible men, the essential point that the discretion left to the executive organs wielding coercive power should be reduced as much as possible is clear enough. While every law restricts individual freedom to some extent by altering the means which people may use in the pursuit of their aims, under the rule of law, the government is prevented from stultifying individual efforts by ad hoc action. Within the known rules of the game, the individual is free to pursue his personal ends and desires, certain that the powers of government will not be used deliberately to frustrate his efforts. The distinction we have drawn before between the creation of a permanent framework of laws within which the productive activity is guided by individual decisions and the direction of economic activity by a central authority is thus really a particular case of the more general distinction between the rule of law and arbitrary government. Under the first, the government confines itself to fixing rules determining the conditions under which the available resources may be used, leaving to the individuals the decision for what ends they are to be used. Under the second, the government directs the use of the means of production to particular ends. The first type of rules can be made in advance, in the shape of formal rules, which do not aim at the wants and needs of particular people. They are intended to be merely instrumental in the pursuit of people's various individual ends, and they are, or ought to be, intended for such long periods that it is impossible to know whether they will assist particular people more than others. They could almost be described as a kind of instrument of production, helping people to predict the behavior of those with whom they must collaborate, rather than as efforts toward the satisfaction of particular needs. Economic planning of the collectivist kind necessarily involves the very opposite of this. The planning authority cannot confine itself to providing opportunities for unknown people to make whatever use of them they like. It cannot tie itself down in advance to general and formal rules which prevent arbitrariness. It must provide for the actual needs of people as they arise, and then choose deliberately between them. It must constantly decide questions which cannot be answered by formal principles only, and, in making these decisions, it must set up distinctions of merit between the needs of different people. When the government has to decide how many pigs are to be raised, or how many buses are to be run, which coal mines are to operate, or at what prices shoes are to be sold, these decisions cannot be deduced from formal principles or settled for long periods in advance. They depend, inevitably, on the circumstances of the moment, and in making such decisions, it will always be necessary to balance one against the other the interests of various persons and groups. In the end, somebody's views will have to decide whose interests are more important, and these views must become part of the law of the land, a new distinction of rank which the coercive apparatus of government imposes upon the people. The distinction we have just used between formal law or justice and substantive rules is very important, and at the same time most difficult to draw precisely in practice. Yet the general principle involved is simple enough. The difference between the two kinds of rules is the same as that between laying down a rule of the road, as in the highway code, and ordering people where to go, or better still, between providing signposts and commanding people which road to take. The formal rules tell people in advance what action the state will take in certain types of situation, defined in general terms, without reference to time and place or particular people. They refer to typical situations into which anyone may get, and in which the existence of such rules will be useful for a great variety of individual purposes. The knowledge that, in such situations, the state will act in a definite way, or require people to behave in a certain manner, is provided as a means for people to use in making their own plans. Formal rules are thus merely instrumental in the sense that they are expected to be useful to yet unknown people for purposes for which these people will decide to use for them, and in circumstances which cannot be foreseen in detail. In fact, that we do not know their concrete effect, that we do not know what particular ends these rules will further, or which particular people they will assist, that they are merely given the form most likely, on the whole, to benefit all the people affected by them, is the most important criterion of formal rules, in the sense in which we here use this term. They do not involve a choice between particular ends or particular people, because we just cannot know beforehand by whom and in what way they will be used. In our age, with its passion for conscious control of everything, it may appear paradoxical to claim as a virtue that under one system we shall know less about the particular effect of the measures the state takes than would be true under most other systems, and that a method of social control should be deemed superior because of our ignorance of its precise results. Yet this consideration is, in fact, the rationale of the great liberal principle of the rule of law, and the apparent paradox dissolves rapidly when we follow the argument a little further. This argument is twofold. The first is economic, and can here only briefly be stated. The state should confine itself to establishing rules applying to general types of situations, and should allow the individuals freedom in everything which depends on the circumstances of time and place, because only the individuals concerned in each instance can fully know these circumstances and adapt their actions to them. If the individuals are to be able to use their knowledge effectively in making plans, they must be able to predict actions of the state which may affect these plans. But if the actions of the state are to be predictable, they must be determined by rules fixed independently of the concrete circumstances which can be neither foreseen nor taken into account beforehand, and the particular effects of such actions will be unpredictable. If, on the other hand, the state were to direct the individual's actions so as to achieve particular ends, its action would have to be decided on the basis of the full circumstances of the moment, and would therefore be unpredictable. Hence, the familiar fact that the more the state plans, the more difficult planning becomes for the individual. The second, moral or political argument, is even more directly relevant to the point under discussion. If the state is precisely to foresee the incidence of its actions, it means that it can leave those affected no choice. Wherever the state can exactly foresee the effects on particular people of alternative courses of action, it is also the state which chooses between the different ends. If we want to create new opportunities open to all, to offer chances of which people can make what use they like, the precise results cannot be foreseen. General rules, genuine laws as distinguished from specific orders, must therefore be intended to operate in circumstances which cannot be foreseen in detail, and, therefore, their effect on particular ends or particular people cannot be known beforehand. It is in this sense alone that it is at all possible for the legislator to be impartial. To be impartial means to have no answer to certain questions, to the kind of questions which, if we have to decide them, we decide by tossing a coin. In a world where everything was precisely foreseen, the state could hardly do anything and remain impartial. Where the precise effects of government policy on particular people are known, where the government aims directly at such particular effects, it cannot help knowing these effects, and therefore it cannot be impartial. It must, of necessity, take sides, impose its valuations upon people, and, instead of assisting them in the advancement of their own ends, choose the ends for them. As soon as the particular